Sir Herbert Thompson, 5. How did you come to leave Number 8 Squadron?
Well, sooner or later, I was supposed to go home for a rest, and I was suddenly sent for by Draper, who succeeded Squadron Commander Bromit, and he said you've been posted to home establishment. Do you want to go? And quite frankly, I didn't like him, so I said yes. And lo and behold, I was posted to East Church, which of course was one of the most historic of all the aerodromes of even before the RNS was invented. It was belonged to the military ring. And I flew a lot there as an instructor, but I think I was only there for about 6 to 7 weeks. And there was a doctor called Granger, and he was a surgeon lieutenant in the Navy, and he was interested in flying. He asked me one day whether I'd take him up. He wanted to fly very high, and he also wanted to do some stunts and see the effect. And so we had a DH-4 with a BH engine, which was only 200 horsepower, but anyway, I thought I'd get it up there, so up we went. And we managed to reach 21,000 feet on the altimeter. I had a frightfully bad cold, but I didn't want to disappoint him. He'd got all his stuff ready, blood pressure things and so on. And on the way down, I thought he hadn't flown before, and I thought I'd give him a loop. And of course, that was a much heavier machine than I'd ever looped before. And I stalled on top. And before she went into a dive and recovered, I remember that there was a battery which was supposed to illuminate the dashboard in case one did night flying, and it fell upwards on its way down to Sittingbourne and hit me an old belt on the nose, which was rather uncomfortable. But all was well, she got. But I was worried about Surgeon Lieutenant Granger in the back seat, wondering if he'd fallen out. And I looked back, and all he was doing was waving around to do it again. And that was my swan song, because almost immediately afterwards, I started earache, and it got worse. The fleet surgeon came and looked at me, and he couldn't diagnose it. And on the other hand, a pupil of mine did diagnose it and said it was a mastoid abscess. I was pouring pus and so on. Fortunately, they couldn't keep me in the sick bay because there was an epidemic of measles, and I was shot out one night to Chatham. Unfortunately, at the hospital there was a Middlesex hospital consultant, and he came up to see what had come in. I can remember him saying, "Good God, sister, operating theatre at once." And that was the end of my flying until the following September, really, because I was at last past fit for light flying, and I was told that I must never fly higher than 3,000 feet. And I started again at the beginning of September, when I was posted to what amounted to Coastal Command. The RAF had come in this time, and to combat the submarines, there were land flying machines were flying around the Cornish coast, and I was posted to one of these. And we had the most depressing aeroplane, because it was a DH-6 sort of mass production school machine, and it had an engine for which it wasn't designed. That was a Curtiss. It had a propeller which wasn't designed for the Curtiss, and with bombs on board. We had a couple of bombs, and I think they were something like 60 pounds each. And if one had dropped them into the sea and had to come back, on one occasion I had to fly up a valley because I couldn't climb the cliffs. I had one glorious experience that off the coast, about 4 miles out, we suddenly saw a little coastal thing torpedoed. There was a frightful west wind, and another chap and I, another flight commander and I, decided we'd go out at once. We didn't think of one of the less experienced pilots could be trusted. Out we went, and I know that I personally flew the thing on, of all instruments, the thermometer, because I knew that if she boiled, I should probably fall in the sea. And of course, DH6 was not equipped for falling in the sea. And once it got up to 99 about, I throttled back, and I found that the man who flew out with me, Lieutenant Tremellin, same thing had happened to him. He was awfully nervous about over revving the engine. Of course, when we got out there, it was 20 minutes to get to go over the 4 miles. The ship had sunk. Everybody was either in a raft or about to be rescued. Of course, the only good we did was to keep the submarine below the surface, because he didn't know that even if he dropped a bomb on it, it probably bounced off. And almost immediately after that, I got a telegram from the Air Ministry to say that I was to join the Air Ministry at once. And they'd been looking for me for quite a long time. Nobody seemed to know where I was. And my old CO, Squadron Commander Bromwich, was now a colonel in the RAF. And he was the head of sea flying training in Training Command. And he and the head of land flying training wanted a staff captain who could fly. But he couldn't be fit enough to go over to France. There was a shortage of pilots, and that end of the war, and they were scraping the bottom of the barrel. I had this glorious job. After my conscience allowed me, I wasn't allowed to fly anymore, and I really enjoyed myself running around England, either ferrying expensive generals who'd forgotten how to fly, or going on journeys of my own. And one of my delights, I went up to the battle cruiser squadron where Furious was, and on some message or other, I forget what I was doing, but there were old friends of mine. There's my great friend Wilfred Eklund and Bill Jordan, who'd been in number 8 with me, and I met the future Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Dixon, and all I can remember of that was that Marconi came out to the Furious, and I couldn't get ashore because there was no picket boat to take me, so I had to wait while he got ashore, and the wind got up and up and up. When I got back again, I had Jordan had promised to lend me a pup to fly me to eastwards to East Fortran from Turnhouse, which I suppose is about 30 miles, I don't know. But all I know is that Jordan said, of course, you Air Ministry blokes can't fly, and that was enough to make me fly. And I went up absolutely vertically in the teeth of the wind and turned round. And I was at East Fortran before the signal got through to say I was coming, and they'd packed up for the night. I did it in about 10 minutes, going over Edinburgh. That's Edinburgh, that was. And I managed to sidle out of the aeroplane and sit on the tail so she didn't blow over, and they rescued me. That was, in a way, the last most exciting flight I ever did. It was in December 1918, and I was demobilised in 1919, because it's fairly easy to get demobilised when you're in the Royal Air Force headquarters, and all I had to do was to walk in with my papers to the right man, and I managed to get up to Oxford the first day of term, of the spring term of 1919. That was my glorious end of flying.
When you were acting as a staff captain at the Air Ministry, serving there, did you fly a variety of aircraft, or always have the same plane?
No, there was a sort of pool, and I'd been promised a Bristol fighter that never came, and I ferried most people in an Avro, and I had a pup of my own, which landed me in a glorious adventure, because I flew across London once in it, with the clouds down to about 300 feet and two cylinders missing. And I didn't know my London streets. The only way I got home to Hindon was by accident, good management. I found St Pancras Station and followed the Midland Railway out.
So that Hendon was your home airfield?
Yes, yes, that's right.
You mentioned the effect of wind and gales and so on. Mm. I know that it would be very drafty, naturally, in an open cockpit. So could you actually feel the wind pushing the aircraft about in the air?
Oh, yes, we did suffer from bumps enormously, but over the wind, the temperature drops 1 degree every 300 feet you go up, and an open cockpit, no heating. And when it came to flying in France in the winter, you lost all feeling, and if you used a switch, you saw your glove reach the switch and turn it off, but you couldn't feel anything. Then the blood came back, but you couldn't move, and you writhed on the ground sometimes in real agony with the blood coming back. And I remember one great friend of mine, number 8, and I said, "What on earth are you doing?" The lobe of his ear had come out of the hole in his flying helmet. He said, "I thought it was very cold." He was frostbitten. Oh, it was cold. You couldn't move, of course. And the comic part of that was that we were very badly equipped in flying gear that they did produce, which I never used, a great leather flying coat. But I personally bought a French aeroplane, rather a boiler suit with fur inside it. And it really was a marvellous thing. And then the RSC produced things the Navy didn't produce, fleece-lined boots. But a flying helmet, I always used my own. They had a sort of sleeve, like a very fat lady's silk stocking, and I pulled that over my head and sort of bent the thing around and had a leather helmet on top. And then my mother made me a mask of fur around my flying goggles. And believe it or not, all those, except the boots, I paid for myself. We didn't go on strike.
Could you give any example of the sort of strain that fighter pilots experienced in the First World War?
Well, I remember once, after I'd been shot down, that I suddenly found myself one night out on the grass, the cold grass, and I crawled out under the railing of the tent, and I was sleepwalking. I'd never sleepwalked before, but for a whole week, every night, I got out of bed and was sleepwalking. More than once, I was collected by the sentry and brought back, and I just sort of disappeared. But I'm quite certain that in the Second War, when they understood these things better, I should have been sent for a rest. I think that illustrates as well as I can say that sort of strain one didn't suffer from.
How did you happen to be shot down on that occasion?
Oh, it was the thing that caused my great admiration for my flight commander Booker, that we were out on the whole flight was in patrol, and he decided to dive on two German aircraft which were some way over the lines. And he dived on them, and I was obediently followed, and was quite excited because they appeared to be dead ducks, and I didn't realize, Booker knew, that they were a decoy for a considerable flight. There were 11 of them, he counted, in the end of the travelling circus up above. And while I was busily engaged in shooting down one of the decoys, there was suddenly a frightful uproar behind me, of two Spandau guns going full out. And I panicked and dived away, which I shouldn't have done, because I couldn't dive an Albatross D3 in a triplane. But the noise stopped immediately, and so I pulled out of the dive I never ought to have got into. And when I looked around to see if I'd been damaged, I saw that my what turned out to be the main spar of my top plane, and a triplane only had one main spar instead of the usual two, had been shattered. There was wood coming out in all directions, and it hadn't folded up. So I decided the only thing I could possibly do this time was to go home, although I'd started to climb back to my flight. And I went home, and when I landed, the moment I began to taxi, as soon as I landed, the air wasn't fast enough to keep up the six ailerons the triplane had, and they just flopped down because the balance wire had been severed. And although I managed to land back on my own airplane, it really was a technical shoot down. And Booker himself, when he came back, said he didn't think he'd get home. But he had come behind and shot a man from the pilot